Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Another busy Sunday night edition of Mooney Goes Wild on Birds, so we're going to get straight into it. Let's start by saying hello to Jim Wilson, who's in Cove in County Cork. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Derek.
So Jim is there. Let's say hello now to Niall Hatch, who's in Greystones in County Wicklow. Hello, Niall.
Hi, Derek. How are you?
And let's stay in Wicklow now as we say hello to Eric Dempsey, who's got a very interesting story for us about birds falling from the sky in Mexico. And if you haven't seen the video, I suggest you log on to our website and have a look. rte.ie/Mooney. Eric, tell us more.
Hello, Derek, and hello, guys from County Wicklow. In the last week, there's been an amazing video has been released from North Mexico. North Mexico is a place where many of North America's birds will spend the winter. It's about a species called yellow-headed blackbird. Now, blackbirds in America, they're not like our blackbirds. They're not members of the thrush family. They're more sort of related to orioles and grackles. But this is an all-blackbird with a bright canary yellow head. So they spend the summer in parts of North America, and thousands upon thousands of them spend the winter in Mexico. This video has captured something quite extraordinary. Picture a suburban, nice American, Mexican suburban area. It looks like a nice area. There's, you know, roads, there's grass verges, there's houses, nice gardens. And there's a CCTV camera, security camera, looking out onto this little street. And then about 4 seconds into the video, out of nowhere, what can only be described as a ball of thousands of birds suddenly appear out of the sky and crash down onto the road, onto the roofs of the houses, into the gardens. It's like an explosion, not going up, but coming down. I'm sure you've seen these underwater films where sharks are surrounding what are called bait balls, where there's thousands of fish in a big bowl. Well, if you can imagine that as birds and being dropped from the sky, almost like a water balloon. You know, you have, when you're kids, you used to fill a balloon with water and you drop it and it would splash all over the place. Well, this is exactly what has happened. This ball of birds suddenly drops out of the sky and splats all over the road. Now, within seconds, thousands of these birds get back up and fly off. But in the aftermath, they found hundreds of these beautiful yellow-headed blackbirds dead on the road, dead on the roofs of houses, dead in the gardens. And of course, then the big question is, what happened? How did this crazy thing happen? And there was lots of theories, you know, 5G masts, various pesticides, electrocution, whatever. There's a whole range of possibilities being put out for this. Now, I have my own views on it, but I would be very interested to hear what Jim and Niall think might have happened. And I would urge your listeners, when we are able to put that up on the website, Derek, go on and have a look at it. You will never see anything like this. This is extraordinary.
Well, I have never seen anything like it. And it is exactly like that balloon filled with water. And then somebody pops it and all the water just... A water bomb is what they would call that if it happened
exactly.
In the sky. And this is like a bird bomb just exploding. It's extraordinary. Niall, have you ever seen anything like it?
No, I haven't. It really is remarkable. And I think Eric's description there is absolutely spot on. Tragic, of course, that so many of these birds died. And you can actually see some of them on the ground, like injured towards the end of the clip, which is always unpleasant to see. But it really looks like the birds were taken by surprise. And what strikes me, it's almost like as if a starling murmuration doing all of these twists and turns in the sky had just suddenly slammed into the ground. And that makes me suspect that it was probably caused by the flock taking unexpected evasive of action, probably towards the top of the group, because we know the way that starlings form murmurations, and presumably these yellow-headed blackbirds do it in a similar way. They're tuned into the motion of the birds closest to them. So when those birds move, they react without even thinking. Their neighbours just will move and follow their pattern. And I'm suspecting what has happened is a predator, perhaps like a hawk or a falcon, has come down on this low-flying flock from above. The birds on the top have swerved to avoid it and taken evasive action, not really taking account of the fact, or not really caring, perhaps. perhaps, that the rest of the flock are very low to the ground and to the rooftops. And as they those birds have reacted and ducked down as well, some of them have just slammed at full force into the roofs and into the road. So, you know, sometimes people ask with starling murmurations, how do they not collide with objects and with each other? And it seems, well, with some birds, if there's an emergency or something goes wrong, they can collide. And they're flying at such high speed, there'll be no way for them to pull out in time. So it really was quite catastrophic for those birds at the bottom of the flock, unfortunately.
It reminded me as well of, you know, when fishermen have a big net of fish and when they open the bottom onto the deck, it's like boomf, and all these birds, and they're, as you say, they're going everywhere. Causes, I would go along with what Niall is suggesting, that there must have been a murmuration of some description for that density of birds. Like, it's thick with them as they hit the road. And the only time you ever see that in the sky is when there's a very tight flock. And the American so-called blackbirds, they gather in huge flocks like starlings. So to get that number together, it's something like that. Now, we've often heard of incidences of like frogs falling out of the sky, like raining frogs. And I know in the Americas, you can have tornadoes and there's an outside chance that a whole lot of them got stuck in something like that and eventually got coughed out onto the road. But I would tend to go with Niall's version of that, because I can't think of anything else to make sense of it.
Well, that was my view also. We have a unanimous decision. That is the only explanation that I can see for an incident like that. You know, when you see starlings in the evening times going to roost and they have this big murmuration, birds like sparrowhawks and peregrine falcons will frequently go through them. So this must have happened at the very top layer, as Niall suggests, because it's like a ripple effect through a murmuration. They all sort of move together. And it looks like it's all well thought through and rehearsed almost, but it's reactive. And that must have been what happened. You know, it must have been a peregrine falcon or one of the birds of prey having a swoop at the top layer, and the top layer moving down and creating this explosion of birds onto the ground. And it is, it's as you say, Jim, a lot of these sort of red-winged blackbirds, yellow-headed blackbirds, these sort of birds can form very large roosts. And they will go into reed beds as well, just like starlings. So they will form these murmurations, but not as spectacular as our starlings. They form big, large, roosting flocks of birds. But that, in my opinion, what has happened in that. But it is, it's an extraordinary sight. And as Niall says, it's very sad to see so many birds killed in such a way. You wouldn't put money on it. You know, it's a one-off. Like, it's a one-off for that to happen. But it's even more remote for it to be actually captured on film. You know, it just happened that there was a CCTV camera on that particular section of the road. If that had happened 100 metres up the road, that would never have been captured. And people probably would be still trying to figure out what happened.
It's extraordinary. But Jim, wasn't there a battle of the starlings back in the, what is it, the 1600s in Cork? Can you explain?
There surely was, Derek. And in fact, listening to Niall and Eric talk about it, it sounds quite the same as this encounter from 1621 in October. I've extracted a few sentences from the report, which was in a pamphlet. And in the 1600s, pamphlets were all the rage. Printing was a little bit over 100 years old, and anyone that had enough money could print whatever they wanted to tell people whatever they wanted. And by the 1620s, some countries had even brought in laws, because fake news is not new. There was fake news back in the 1600s, big time. One thing we don't know is how people who read these pamphlets perceived them. Did they take them dead seriously, or did they know that there was a little bit of poetic license in the stories and their credibility? But wait till you hear this. It's fantastic. It's one of my favourite pieces, these pamphlets. And there's quite a number of them written about natural history events. And really what they're doing is, in this particular one, is they're using a story which probably has some truth to it, probably a murmuration of starlings, but it's grown arms and legs in order for the person who got it printed, the writer, to actually give a message to people. And in this case, it's a religious message about you better be good or you're going to be in trouble. basically. So I'll just give you a couple of lines here and there to give you a flavour of this. Now, this was written in 1622 about an incident in October 1621. The English at the time, I can just about read it, so forgive me if I stumble now and again. So the title is fantastic. The Wonderful Battle of Starlings, fought at the city of Cork in Ireland, the 12th and 14th of October, 1621. As it hath been credibly informed by noblemen and others of that fair kingdom. So to the reader, at this very start of it, it says, it's not impossible for the Almighty God to alter and change the ordinary course or disposition of the creatures which he hath made. This is very important for the story. And then he goes on to tell you how this is 100% true, the story, because it was certified by letters from right honourable persons and worthifulness persons and other of good reputation now in London, who were eyewitnesses to the event. These strange news out of Ireland had been printed before this time, but that had been stayed still until the truth was fully certified and examined. In other words, it's true. And now, a couple of sentences here and there. As may appear by their flights, keeping together all times of year, except in the breeding season. So, That rings okay. Starlings, you see the big flocks outside of the breeding season. During the breeding season, you rarely see them in flocks at all. It is and hath been an old proverb that birds of a feather hold and keep together. But now the old proverb is changed. For at this time, they met to fight together the most bitterest and sharpest battle amongst themselves. The like, for the manner of their fight and for the time the battle did continue, never heard or seen at any time in any country in the world. They mustered together at this above named city of Cork for 4 or 5 days before they fought their battle. It's been described like humans would have fought a battle at the time. Every day, more and more of these creatures and their armies with greater supplies came from the east. Others came from the west. They noticed as well that there was flocks travelling between the two camps as if there was some sort of negotiation going on. So then, getting to the actual fight itself, they forthwith at once took wing and so mounted up into the skies, encountered one another with such a terrible shock as they found amazed the whole city and all the beholders. Upon this sudden and fierce encounter, there fell down into the city and into the rivers multitudes of starlings, some with wings broken, some with legs and necks broken, some with their eyes pecked out, some their bills thrust into their breasts and sides of their adversaries. And I mean, so it goes on. It goes on in this vein. And what's very interesting, that was on the Saturday, the 12th. On the Sunday, they moved to London. There was another battle there, seen by loads and loads of people, loads of witnesses. Monday, they came back to finish off the battle. And then this one is quite interesting, because what they say is they encountered each other with like violence assaults as formerly they had done on the Saturday. But at this last battle, there was a kite, a raven and a crow, all three found dead in the streets, rent, torn and mangled. There you go. And that was all true. The Battle of the Starlings in Cork in 1621.
Now, you never mentioned the illustrations, Jim, that accompany it, because this is why it's relevant to the story we've just been talking about in Mexico, because the illustration is very powerful.
It is. The illustration is fantastic. And it actually is very, very similar to Eric's brilliant description of that piece of video from Mexico. You've got streams of starlings and then they're colliding and then falling like a waterfall down onto the ground with Cork City in the background. And I sent you on a link there, Derek, of a song that was composed to commemorate the 400th anniversary, which was last year, of this famous battle. and it was by the Diviners, a local folk group here in Cork, a really, really good group, and they composed and performed this song.
Well, we'll have a listen. Why not, guys? Would you like to hear it, Jim and Niall and Eric?
Absolutely. Let's go for it.
Why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
The Battle of the Starlings. Here it is.
12th of October, 1621. They went on a hill by the Lee. She danced when he sang, sweet tide waters ran, full of promise for them to the sea. He kissed her and told her, this day I will hold to my breast for the rest of our lives. Leaves gold on the trees in the late autumn breeze. I am proud now to call you my wife. From the sun rising high in a deep eastern sky comes a shadow more sudden than night. Lock your doors, bar the windows, the townspeople cry. Sky demons are marching to fight. Then the dark wind they heard was the wings of the birds. When over Cork City they rose, a black storm of sea surging over the lee, a strangeness on all of our homes. Hold me close, darling, I dream of starlings.
Very nice. I like that sound. Cork folk group the Diviners with their tribute to the Battle of the Starlings, which took place in the skies over Cork City in 1621, if you're to believe the news of the day. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Jim, for bringing that to us. Now, for something, as they say, completely different. Stay with us. It'll make sense in just a moment, because over many millions of years, the world's 10,000 or so bird species have evolved to occupy a greater range of habitats and geographic locations than any other group of vertebrates. From baking deserts to freezing poles, and from lush rainforests to stark open ocean, they have been able to survive in many apparently hostile environments, thanks to a range of amazing adaptations that have helped them to thrive where other animals would perish. Birdwatchers have long marvelled at the unique traits that have evolved to allow birds to excel in their various ecological niches, and which make them such wonderful animals to watch and study. So, on tonight's edition of Mooney Goes Wild, two of Ireland's top ornithological experts, namely Jim Wilson in the red and white corner for Cork, and Niall Hatch in the royal blue, gold and white corner for Wicklow, face off in an attempt to outdo each other with their most impressive and outlandish bird adaptation facts in a special segment we're calling The Battle of the Birders! Niall Hatch, you're first up. You're going to begin by telling us about the world's most poisonous bird, the hooded pitiwi from Papua New Guinea. Seconds out, round one.
Well, it really is remarkable. But when to first look at this bird, or when you see a photograph of it, you would think that there's nothing particularly remarkable about it. It's certainly not an unattractive bird. It's mostly sort of a brownish colour with a dark hood, a blackish hood on its head. So it's nice, but there's lots of other nicer looking birds in Papua New Guinea and in that part of the world. And so it's a bird that had really, I suppose, hadn't really got much attention from ornithologists. People thought they knew everything about it. They worked out it's actually a member of or a close relative of the oriole family. And so it was thought that, well, okay, just another bird in the forest, what does it really matter? But then there were researchers there some years ago who were catching birds in mist nets to ring them, to put rings on their legs and measure them and so on, and take blood samples. And one of the researchers realised that after he had been handling these birds, these hooded pitahuis, when he touched his lips or his tongue, he would get a numbing sensation. and it was almost like an anesthetic effect. And he thought this was very curious. What could be causing this? And it turns out that this bird's claim to fame now, it was the first bird discovered that is actually poisonous. So we don't really think of birds as being poisonous or being, you know, causing any kind of illness or anything if someone would eat them or touch them. But it turns out that the toxins in this bird's feathers are extremely powerful. And they're exactly the same family or group of toxins as are found in poison dart or poison arrow frogs that you find in the Americas. These frogs, I've seen them in Panama myself. They are brightly colored. There's many different species. Some are bright red, some are blue, some are green. But they're always easy to find because they just stay out very prominently out in the open because they know that no predator will be foolish enough to eat them. Because some of those frogs are so poisonous that if you touch them, you can die just from absorbing through your skin. And certainly if you ate one, you would die. Well, it's the same with this bird from New Guinea. If a predator was to try consume it, it would certainly get extremely sick, but it may die because this toxin is so, so powerful. So much so that even the small amount that was left on this researcher's finger was enough to make his mouth go numb and to make him feel ill. So the question was, well, how has this evolved? How can birds do this? Because surely they're not producing poisons themselves. And it turns out, yes, that's true. They're not. They get it from their diet in exactly the same way as the frogs do. What's happening is they are actually eating certain types of beetle that have this toxin in them. Many insects have developed toxicity, so they're distasteful, even completely poisonous to predators. And these birds have then managed to synthesize or absorb these poisons. They don't harm them themselves. They're immune to them, but they can excrete them then through their feathers and through their skin. And this has been very successful for this bird because it's a common species in the forests. And the local people who live there were able to say that this is a horrible bird. This is a bird that's no good for anything. You can't eat it. So it's obviously worked. They don't hunt it. They leave it alone. But then it also turned out that there were other species of pitahui which look very, very similar to this bird. There's three or four other species. It turns out that some of those are also poisonous and some of them are not. But it turns out that none of these birds are actually related to each other. They're not belonging to closely related groups at all. It's what we call convergent evolution. This, in the same way that you'll get birds and other creatures that have an aversion to a bee or a wasp, something that is black and yellow striped, you also get creatures such as hoverflies, which are completely harmless, perfectly edible, but they have this black and yellow striping, so the birds and the other predators avoid them. It's the same with some of these birds in New Guinea. Some of them have evolved to look almost identical to the poisonous bird, but they're harmless, but they still get the protection of those colours. In these cases, it's not a bright colour, it's just brown and black, quite muted, but it's still enough to ward off the predators that might feed on them. And then even then, some of the other birds that look very similar to have also evolved this toxicity. We're not quite sure how that mechanism works, but it's a lot more to be discovered with that, I think, because toxicity in birds is not something that really has been researched before. It wasn't known until quite recently. So I just thought it was a really remarkable story. I've never been to New Guinea. I'd certainly love to get out there sometime. It's one of the best places for birds on the whole planet, and it's some of the most undisturbed habitat in the world is still to be found there. It's famous, most famous in bird terms, I suppose, for the birds of paradise, which live there. But that shouldn't just be all the colourful bright birds that get all the attention, because maybe the most remarkable bird of all is one of its drabbest in plumage.
Thank you, Niall. Seconds out, round two. Jim Wilson.
Derek, going from the exotic to something that most people would see, especially during the summer by the seaside, seabirds, they live on the sea, they're in salty water all the time, and they're eating from the sea and they're ingesting huge amounts of salt, sodium chloride. Now, if you were to ingest or take in as much of that seawater as a bird does, your kidneys would pack up. We couldn't handle that amount of salt. But seabirds, almost all of them, have evolved like a second set of kidneys. And believe it or not, they're actually situated at the front of the skull, usually just over the eyes. What happens is the blood goes up through these salt glands and salt is extracted from them. It then comes out the nose, down the beak and drips off the tip of it. If you watch a gull on a pier for more than 5 or 10 minutes, you will almost certainly see a drop of what looks like water coming off the end of its beak. And that is actually salt-rich fluid that has been extracted from the body of the bird to help it survive living in this very harsh environment where there's salt in everything it takes in. I find that quite incredible how, unlike the land birds, which don't have these salt glands because they don't encounter seawater, the seabirds, in order to learn to live from the sea, have had to evolve this amazing piece of their survival kit, really, which is the salt glands that they have just in the front of their skull. They're a filter. They're for taking out poisons, stuff we don't want flowing around our bodies.
Nice one, Jim. Seconds away, round three, Niall Hatch.
Adaptations in birds really are remarkable. They've had tens of millions of years, maybe even hundreds of millions of years to perfect them. As we discussed recently on the programme, that they're evolved from dinosaurs. We know, in fact, they are dinosaurs. There's no difference now between a bird and a dinosaur. And so they've had a long time to perfect these adaptations. And birds have been able to occupy a wider range of niches in the world than any other higher vertebrate. They're at home in all forms of water. You find them at the poles, you find them in the deserts, you find them in the jungles, in the rainforests, in the bogs, everywhere. Birds are everywhere. And this is because they're so supremely adapted to their habitats. One of the supreme examples of this to me is the group of birds known as the woodpeckers. Now, here in Ireland, we now have the great spotted woodpecker, which colonised Ireland, started around 2005 and has slowly but surely been spreading across Ireland ever since then. But there are many, many other species of woodpecker around the world, and they all share very similar traits in terms of the way that they live and the way that their bodies are designed. Everything for woodpeckers is for life on the vertical. So they've evolved to have one of their toes. Most birds have four toes on each foot, and woodpeckers are no exception to that. But most birds have three toes forward, one toe back. Woodpeckers have evolved, or at least most species have, that one of those forward toes has rotated backwards, so they have two forward, two back, which allows them to perch or pose themselves perfectly on the branch or the trunk of a tree, going vertically. They have stiffened tail feathers that act like a prop, so they can lean back, holding on with their claws, and that tail will hold them in place without snapping or bending. So these stiffened tail feathers hold them in place. And then what they do is they use that as sort of leverage to fire their heads forward and to drum rapidly on a tree. Now, when you hear a woodpecker drumming, which is what you can hear around this time of year now, they're starting to drum here in Ireland, they're rapidly hitting the tree multiple times per second. You couldn't count the individual taps, it's so fast. When they're doing that, they're hitting that trunk of the tree at full force with their face and achieving a stress or a force of around between 1200 and 1400 G. Now, a blow of 100 G is enough to cause severe concussion in a human or indeed kill us. And these birds can withstand 12 to 14 times that stress, no problem whatsoever. There are special ligaments in their neck that reinforce it. Their brain is encased in a shock-absorbing material so that it absorbs the blows, it doesn't cause brain damage. And then when they've chiseled out a hole to get the insects or the insect larvae they're looking for, they then have a specially adapted tongue that's extremely long. The woodpeckers have long beaks already, but obviously to get the tongue out of there, it has to be much longer than the beak again. And it's so long that they actually have evolved a special tube on the top of their skull. Their tongue actually curls around the back of their head under their skin, so it can be three times longer than the length of their beak. The tip of it is sort of sticky. It's got a brush-like substance or structure on the outside of it. They put it into the hole. The insect larvae will adhere to it. They whip it out and put it into their mouths. So in terms of adaptation, I think that's just remarkable. I think that's up there with Jim's championing of the seabirds for their ability to excrete salt. It's just amazing what birds can do. That's just one example. Everywhere you look in the natural world, there are just amazing examples of birds and other creatures that are perfectly adapted for their environment and lifestyles.
Oh, very good, Niall. Seconds out, round four, Jim Wilson.
You mentioned toes, Niall. Did you know that the grey heron, hopefully most of our listeners have seen a grey heron, that very tall bird that you often see standing very still at the side of a river or even on the coast waiting for a fish or a shrimp to come close enough for it to get its big dagger-like beak out and grab it quickly. Well, the middle toe, forward-pointing toe of a grey heron has a built-in comb for grooming itself. The term is used as a pectinate toe. And basically what it is, when you look at it up close, it literally looks like one side has all these little grooves, just like a hair comb. So that when it's cleaning its feathers, and they've got big feathers and lots of long feathers, they can actually run the feathers through the toe. The toe just keeps on grooming it and getting rid of all broken bits of feathers that are no longer, parts of the feathers that aren't working anymore. And it's not just the grey heron that has this. Their cousins, the little egret, which we've talked about on this programme before, the little white heron that has come to Ireland in the last few decades and is now quite common, they have it. Their cousins, the bitterns, on Bunnan Bui, the bitteran, also has it. The barn owl has it as well, and the nightjars, another group. So not all birds have this built-in comb, but whether that means that these birds are more vain than other birds, I'm not sure. But definitely when it comes to grooming, they have that added advantage of a built-in comb.
Jim, Niall, it's unanimous. It's a draw. Oh, what a battle of the birders. Wasn't it just fantastic? Thank you to Jim and Niall. We'll do it again in a couple of weeks' time. But right now, it's time to remind you of your opportunity to win €1,000 in this year's RTE Eye on Nature Wildlife Photographic Competition. Here are the details. Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike, as RTE Eye on Nature, Ireland's wildlife photography competition, returns. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates and more, The Today Show on RTE One and Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the OPW. See rte.ie/eyeonnature for more.
RTE.
Supporting artists,
supporting us.
That's where you go for details on how to enter this year's wildlife photographic competition. You've got to be over 18 and you must enter only one photograph, and please do not interfere with any animal or habitat or disturb any creature while taking photographs. All right, all the details, rte.ie/eyeonnature. Let's move on. Now, every year, the reed warbler embarks on an epic journey from Northern Europe to Sub-Saharan Africa in one of nature's most extraordinary feats of pinpoint navigation. It has long been thought that they make use of the Earth's magnetic field to precisely target the same breeding site year after year from thousands of kilometres away. But just how they do it has remained unclear until now. Dr. Joe Wynn, formerly of Oxford University, is the lead author of a new study and currently researcher at the Institute for Avian Research in Germany. Joe, thank you very much indeed for taking part in the programme today. Can you tell us about your research?
Yeah, well, thanks very much for having us. What we wanted to look at was something that, you know, I find particularly exciting, which is the fact that small birds that weigh less than a teaspoon are capable of leaving their breeding sites. And these are reed warblers. They breed all the way across Europe, and they are capable of leaving these breeding sites, and they fly across Europe, across the Sahara Desert, and they winter in sub-Saharan Africa, at which point they spend the winter there, and then they return with what it can only be described as like an unbelievable level of accuracy, often to breed not only in the same part of the same country, but often in the same reed bed. And what we as researchers wanted to ask was how they did this. And so we're talking about navigation on a continental scale, and there's only a handful of cues that could really underpin something like this. And for a long time now, animal biologists have thought that one of the key pieces of information that a bird might use to guide these return journeys is information extracted from the Earth's magnetic field. And when we talk about this, we really mean three pieces of information in particular. The first is the intensity of the field, i.e. how strong is the field in a given area. The second is the declination of the field, which is the difference between magnetic and true north. And the third, and perhaps the most important one for the study that we're concerning ourselves with, is the inclination of the field. Now, this is the angle between the Earth's magnetic field and the Earth's surface. It's probably the least intuitive to understand, which is annoying, why it's probably the most important.
Well, it sounds very complicated for somebody like me, I have to admit. But do you think the birds understand all this, or does it just come naturally to them?
Yes, it's a good question. So what we thought was, well, you know, if you're going to remember a position in space, then the problem with the Earth's magnetic field is that it moves very slightly between years. Not a lot, but it moves very slightly. And what this means is that unlike the magnets that you put on the fridge, then the magnetic field in a given position is going to move slightly year on year. And so an inherited mechanism is not going to cut it, because if you inherit a, you know, a magnetic coordinate, for example, then that coordinate's going to move, and then in 100 years' time, it's not going to be very useful at all. So this, we think, has to involve a degree of learning. So they have, you know, this is, you know, in the same way that they learn to do all sorts of things, we wondered whether they could learn to use the Earth's magnetic field. And what might be to the bird's disadvantage, the field moving, we thought actually could be to our advantage as researchers, insofar as we can predict where the bird might return to based on the movement of the magnetic field, which, you know, researchers much more clever than me, you know, physicists and the like, and geophysicists have been tracking for years now. And so for each reed warbler, we can come up with a site that we would expect it to be recovered at if it was using a particular cue. And so what we did was say, well, look, do they actually get recovered closer to those sites than would be expected by chance? And the way we looked at this is using ringing data, which is really simply just essentially loads of people all over Europe catch reed warblers in very fine mist nets. So these are like nets, and they're caught under license all over Europe, but not necessarily by scientists, just by anyone who's, you know, got the necessary qualifications and is an enthusiast. And what we said was, well, you know, when they get caught, they get a little metal ring on their leg, and this allows an individual to be tracked through its life. So if another ringer catches it, then what we can look at is whether the distance moved between ringing and what we call recovery is predicted by these movements of the magnetic field. And what we found was that birds seemed to essentially follow the value for inclination that was representative of where they were born the previous year. But we found that this wasn't true of declination and intensity, which are the other cues that we thought might be important when you know, when considering these sort of very, very long distance migrations. But the problem, obviously, with using inclination on its own is that lots and lots of places in the world have the same inclination value. In fact, like, it is approximately proportional to latitude. So all positions on the same latitude have the same inclination. And so we were left asking, well, you know, if we can only find evidence for inclination, then how can birds use this on its own? And so we came up with this idea that birds might use it as what we called a stop sign, which was really simply that the birds are already traveling in a direction from their wintering sites. And so they're already coming in along an angle. And as soon as they get to the inclination that represents their breeding site, then we said, well, why don't they stop? And again, this, you know, we can actually really precisely predict where for each reed warbler we expect them to be recovered if they were using this mechanism.
Right.
And so we tested this, and this is what we found to be the most likely explanation for the pattern of ringing recoveries that we observed, that birds use inclination on its own as what might be termed a stop site.
Hi, Joel. Nice to talk to you. I've read the reports on your paper. One thing that really striking me is, you know, we're hearing now about satellite tags and geolocators and all sorts of technology that we're starting to use to study birds. I have been told more and more, and I've read more and more, that the use of the little metal ring on the birds is of little value now. Until I read this paper, which is absolutely mind-blowing, that the fact that some of the oldest ways of tagging birds and trying to study what they do is now turning out to be of huge value. But can you tell me a little bit more about that and how you came up with the idea to go back to the old technology and look at that data, how you came up with the idea of this particular study?
Yeah, no, so it's they're both excellent points. To come to your first one, then absolutely, I think, you know, every method of addressing scientific problems comes with, you know, requisite advantages and disadvantages. And, you know, the ringing data is fantastic because it goes back so long into the past, and it will take a very long time for modern technologies to, you know, be gathered over that timescale. Well, necessarily it will take about a century. And on top of that, then I can't remember how much a bird ring is worth. I would think it's probably less than 1 cent in euros. And so whereas the sort of, I've worked on Manx shearwaters for my PhD, and, you know, the tags we put on those, you know, the GPSs were worth about 50 euros and the geolocators were worth about 100. And so, you know, think about how many rings you can get for that. So the sort of the coverage that ringing gives you is on a continental scale. And the time window over which it's gathered is so large that really it will take a very long time for us to get anywhere near that when it comes to things like satellite tags, like geolocators. And so, you know, for the foreseeable future, then ringing, you know, in my opinion, ringing data will have, you know, fantastic utility for, you know, I can't imagine that going away anytime soon. With regards to like how we thought of this, then, you know, to be honest, like, as I say, like my PhD was on shearwaters. I've been working on Copeland in Northern Ireland and Skoma in Southwest Wales since 2016, GPS tracking shearwaters. And obviously in 2020, we couldn't do any of that. So we were sort of scrambling for things to do while sat at home. And yeah, like me and Ollie Padgett, Tim Guildford, Joe Morford, Paris Jaggers and Henrik Moritzen, who are the other guys on the paper, you know, we just sat on Zoom and slowly these ideas come together. And then, yeah, it's come out quite nice, but it's quite surreal. Like, you know, the sort of background being that this was a bit of a hatchet job to try and put stuff together for my PhD.
Yeah, COVID, you know, it was a tough time for everybody, but it did have a silver lining for those of us interested in nature. More people were getting out and about. People who hadn't looked at nature before were looking at nature. And we discussed this many times over the last couple of years and has been a great benefit to people. But you were talking about your study of the shearwaters and their cousins, the albatrosses. I've been very, very privileged and lucky to go to the Southern Ocean and see these magnificent birds on the ocean. And you see them, you know, hundreds of miles away from land, and it looks like there's no features on the sea at all. You can't see any signposts, no roads, no nothing. And there's one amazing satellite track of a wandering albatross. And it's in South Georgia, a little island in the middle of the South Atlantic, hundreds of miles from anywhere. And the bird leaves its partner, who's sitting on an egg, travels all the way up to Brazil and Uruguay, and then travels down to Tierra del Fuego at the bottom of South America. And after about 2 weeks, flies back to the nest at South Georgia. Quite incredible that it knows it needs to get back home, but it formed a perfect triangle, which tells me that this bird knows exactly where it is all the time. I'm just wondering, Joe, your amazing study, you know, is showing again how little we know. And I just want to know what you think of how much we know so far and, you know, what's out there to be discovered in the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is always the always the way with like science is, you know, the more questions you ask, you don't necessarily get answers. You just get more questions. I mean, with the stuff we've done with reed warblers, then obviously this is correlative work. So we look at natural variation in the Earth's magnetic field. We look at real reed warblers moving in nature. And obviously this comes with like a fantastic, as I say, sort of resolution. The space over which we have data for is phenomenal, and the time span over which we have data is amazing. But at the end of the day, like the problem with these kind of studies is that it is correlative. So it's always necessarily possible that the results you find are caused by correlations between the variable you're interested in and variables that you're not interested in. And obviously, the first thing you do with studies like this is try and rule that out. But what it does mean is that, you know, the process by which we accumulate knowledge is to come up with hypotheses, test them with these correlative data, And then we take it to the laboratory and we sort of drill into the infinitesimal detail of it. And so, you know, in many respects, we've come an awful long way over the last century. I mean, it's very strange to think that bird navigation and, you know, the idea of very long distance migration was something that people like speculated about and hypothesized about, but, you know, didn't really know about until the early 1900s with the first ringing schemes. Again, to go back to the sort of utility of ringing. But yeah, like, I mean, how, you know, as I say, these mechanisms we're suggesting are only a small part of what birds must have access to. And, you know, when we think about these sort of great ocean goers like the albatross, then the sort of sensory basis of that is still largely unclear, although it looks like the sense of smell is very important for that, like an olfactory sense. And so, and yeah, so we have a lot to learn, which is good if like me, you like asking these kinds of questions.
Hi, Joe, it's Niall here. Really fascinating research. And I'm really, I've been amazed all my life, I think, about how birds manage to migrate. It's good to be getting at least some of the answers, or getting, I suppose, to the bottom of at least part of how they do it. I've always been curious, though, when it comes to the magnetic field of the Earth, how do the birds actually perceive this? Do they have a special organ that allows them to sense it? Can they see it in some sense? Or do we know how they do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question and goes back to the every answer we get leads to more questions sort of idea. But, and I should probably preface this by saying that I'm not the best placed to answer this kind of thing. But we've, as a community, coalesced on one of two theories, or maybe even both of two theories being the right answer. And they are that birds might have small magnets, small particles of metal in the top of their beak, which could potentially react to the Earth's magnetic field. And there is some evidence that this is true. But the sort of prevailing theory, and the one that is, you know, perhaps surprising to hear as the prevailing theory, is this idea that birds might use chemical reactions in their eye that the yield of which is dependent on the Earth's magnetic field, that these reactions might allow birds to process magnetic information in their eye, and then that information travels to the same part of the brain where birds process visual information. So it's not inconceivable that birds might actually see the Earth's magnetic field. Although, you know, there's some pretty good lines of evidence for this. Birds, for example, seem to struggle to see the Earth's magnetic field in low light conditions, or when they're only exposed to very specific wavelengths of light. They struggle. They seem to require blue light, which would suggest that this is some kind of light-dependent reaction. And this has been repeated several times now. And the idea here is that radio waves will disrupt this chemical reaction. In fact, what they will do is they will disrupt this quantum physical mechanism upon which this reaction is predicated. And so whilst, again, we're not 100% sure, I think the sort of best evidence suggests that birds probably see the Earth's magnetic field.
So, Joe, does that mean that electromagnetic interference could be a major issue for migratory birds? Or do you know if a bird finds itself next to a large magnet, does that somehow disorient it or confuse it? And also, what occurs to me as well, just as a related question, every so often in the history of the Earth, the magnetic poles of the Earth have shifted. The last time this happened, I think, was around 780,000 years ago. But it seems to happen at random. It could happen again. It will happen again at some point, maybe not in our lifetimes. But I suppose if that happened, that could cause chaos for migratory birds, if that sense is so important to them finding their way back home.
Yeah, so both are brilliant questions. To come to the first one, there's a very cool paper that was published in Nature, the journal Nature, in 2014 by Henrik Moritzson, who helped us on this paper, where essentially they looked at anthropogenic radio waves, so radio waves with a human origin, at their campus at the University of Oldenburg in North Germany. And what they found was that, yes, radio waves were capable of disrupting the magnetic sense of European robins on migration. And it's a very, very, very nice experiment. The question of how this interferes with the movement of wild birds moving in situ is a slightly different question, because obviously we know that birds use the magnetic field, but we also know that it's probably not the most important sense that's available to them. We know that birds also use the stars. They can use the sort of pattern of rotation of the stars in order to determine where the pole is. And we also know that they can use the sun. They have what's called a time-compensated sun compass, which is essentially a sundial in reverse. You know, if you know the time of day, you can work out the direction. And so within the context of migration more generally, we don't know how problematic radio waves might be. We know that in a vacuum, they can cause disorientation, but obviously there will need to be a lot more work to work out what the, you know, how serious this is in the wild. And I'm really sorry, whilst doing that answer, I've forgotten your second question.
It was about the shifting of the poles, Joe.
That's a really cool question to do with the poles. And it's interesting that the mechanism that we propose in this manuscript is based upon learned information. So as long as the pole doesn't flip massively whilst you're in Africa, and my understanding of these things is that they, whilst on a sort of geological timescale, they are pretty much instantaneous, they're not completely instantaneous, then it's probably fine because, as I say, the mechanism is learnt and it's also not used in isolation. I would be very surprised if this was the only information that birds use to find their way home. And so, as with any sort of, you know, naturally selected evolved system, we might expect a certain degree of redundancy, although what that would be, we don't really know. Although, you know, if we accept that that is the case, then the very fact that birds are still here and still using these mechanisms probably means that they do have some means of compensation.
I'm curious, Joe, in relation specifically to the reed warbler, because that's a species that I know it's quite a common bird in Britain and across much of continental Europe. Here in Ireland, it's still a scarce species. It's slowly been expanding its range here since the 1980s, perhaps limited by a lack of suitable habitat in some areas, because as the name suggests, they do really need reed beds where possible. But I'm wondering if these birds are so fixed on stopping at a certain point, and I take a point that it's not the only mechanism that they use, but the magnetic field acts like a stop sign, as you're saying. Does that somehow limit or inhibit their ability to colonize new areas if they're so fixed on returning to the same latitude, more or less? And also, would that affect their ability to cope with things like climate change, where the climate zones are shifting? Perhaps the southern part of the ranges are becoming less hospitable for those birds and their climate zone is shifting further north. Would that be a limiting factor, do you think?
Obviously, the way we design our analyses is that we try and take into account things like the changing climate, and also for us, the changing distribution of ringers when we're trying to predict whether birds are going to be recovered. And so using the analysis that we've done, it's very hard to comment on how they might shift their range in response to climate. But we do know that, you know, birds more generally are capable of shifting their ranges in response to climate change, whether this is through individual birds learning to go to a different place, so arriving home and going, you know what, I don't fancy it this year, I'm going to go further north, or whether this is underpinned by natural selection, this is the idea being that birds that are in the wrong habitat don't make it to breed and birds in the right habitat do, is, you know, this is a sort of big question in biology, and I think it probably depends on the species in question. Though, as you say, like reed warblers are, you know, not only now, you know, colonizing bits of, my understanding of the Irish birds is not perfect. My understanding is that East Ireland is better for them, but also Southern Scotland now as well. And so, yeah, I think so. They do seem to be moving their range. But what this reflects, whether this reflects learning or not, I'm not too sure.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, Joe. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure. Don't forget, tomorrow night on RT Radio 1, another edition of Mooney Goes Wild. Our panel will be Richard Collins and Aine Nealana. That's here from 10 p.m. My thanks tonight to Eric Dempsey, Jim Wilson and Niall Hatch. Not forgetting our researcher, John Bellarotti. Until tomorrow night, goodbye, 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 goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.